It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. Later in the hour, Obama is again facing pressure to take action on Syria. We'll take a look at the ongoing humanitarian crisis there.
First, the Olympics in Sochi are winding down after a lot of concerns surrounding security and accommodations in the days leading up to the Games. By all reports, the Games have gone relatively smoothly.
And one of the most popular events in the last 2 weeks has been hockey, both for the men's and women's teams. In a heartbreaking loss yesterday, the women of the Team USA gave up a 2-0 lead to lose the gold to Canada. And the men's gold medal match will take place on Sunday.
As we heard here on Central Time from a sports reporter at the beginning of the games, both the men and women's hockey teams have a good deal of Wisconsin representation. There are 8 former Badgers between the two teams.
Earlier today, we spoke with the Wall Street Journal reporter covering hockey in Sochi. Because of the time difference, we had to speak with her before today's semifinal match between U.S. and Canada.
The game just wrapped up in the last few hours, and as you may have heard, the U.S. fell to Canada by a 1-0 score. Sharon Turlip is a sports reporter at the Wall Street Journal and has been witness to the highs and lows of all the big games.
Sharon, thanks for joining us from Sochi.
Glad to be here.
Well, put the games for us in context. How big of a deal are these hockey events, not just at the Olympics, but in Russia specifically?
Oh, I mean, for anyone who saw any part of the Russia-U.S. game or who experienced the Russians after the defeat, I mean, the game is huge here. Even though they don't have a horse in the race, there's expected to be a big amount of fans here. So, I mean, definitely the Russian elimination from the games has deflated everything. I mean, it's palpable here, but still an important game. And I think the Russians are rooting for the Canadians mostly, as we've talked to folks.
Well, tell us about that. I mean, how has the town reacted? How has the country reacted?
Yeah, I mean, it kind of depends on who you talk to. But, I mean, there's no the figure skating victory last night, the Russians won figure skating gold. I mean, that was a really big deal. It helped lift the mood somewhat. But this whole country was riding on hockey. I mean, hockey is, it's a big deal here. It's an important legacy. Putin was at the game. There's pictures of, him there with kind of his head in his hand. So it's really a mixed feeling. I mean, I think people are, thrilled and proud to have the games here, but it would have been absolutely electric if the Russians would have made it to a medal round.
Right. And, I mean, even in the figure skating event, that didn't come without some controversy of its own.
It did, but I think when you're on the winning end of controversy, the controversy maybe isn't as much of a big deal. I mean, I can assure you the Russians aren't talking about the controversy right now.
So were the Russians banking on a rematch of the Miracle on Ice this year?
It's interesting. I mean, I think the Russians, for the Russians, the really big rivalry is with Canada. So Russia's dream would have been to face Canada. I mean, for the Americans, the Miracle on Ice is really the pinnacle of U.S. hockey. But the Canadians and the Russians were so competitive for so long in the 70s and 80s that really would have been the dream match for them.
Men's and women's hockey are both particularly exciting for us here in Wisconsin because the two teams there have 8 former Badgers within them, and the women missed out on the gold yesterday in a very close match. Could you tell us about that game?
Yeah, I mean, that was, I think that was just crushing for the women. They had a news conference this morning with some of the leaders, with Julie Chu, and it was their nightmare loss, and their spirits had been so high leading into the game, and they'd beaten the Canadians in the games leading up to the Olympics, and I think they thought they were really going to win. So, I mean, it was pretty, I'd say as a reporter, even talking to the women after the game was somewhat hard. I mean, I don't think I've, ever seen athletes as emotional as they were. It's another 4 years. It's not like they get to go back and play in the NHL or win a Stanley Cup or make millions of dollars. This was kind of it for them. So, they were really trying to work on being positive. Julie Chu was trying to remind the players that winning a silver medal is a really big deal and trying to get them to focus on that. But, it was a hard time for them.
Well, it must be hard when I bet they're replaying the same things that at least U.S. media are replaying with the hockey puck headed straight for the open goal and then hitting the goalpost and flinging off to the left and out of bounds. Is that something that just continues to weigh on their conscience?
Yeah, I mean, some of them said today, you know, they really didn't sleep last night. You know, they kept talking about, you know, hockey's a game of a bounce here and a bounce there. Coach Katie Stone, who's always positive, you know, and she wasn't negative after last night's game, but she said, you know, you have nights where you think, you know, maybe things just aren't going your way, which for her was, you know, kind of a lot to say. And yes, I mean, definitely you're reliving that moment.
Yeah. Can you tell us a bit about the atmosphere of these games? American hockey games can get kind of wild. Is it like that in Russia, too?
You know, it's actually not for as big as, I mean, there's definitely energy. And being at the game, the Russia-U.S. game, tremendous excitement. But one of the things that was really noticeable is in that game when the goal was taken back, really, the Russian crowd, they didn't really react. And if that was an NHL game, I mean, you would have had booing and yelling, and, you know, it would have been crazy, and there just wasn't that. So there's a lot of cheering, but it's not, you know, it's not the kind of, it's not really antagonistic. They don't seem to kind of try to intimidate the other team the way that, you know, a lot of fans in the U.S. have kind of mastered.
Well, the semifinal match between Canada and the U.S. is about to begin, and you're there right now. We'll know the results of that game by the time that this interview airs, but as someone who's getting ready to watch this game, what are you looking out for?
You know, I think the Canadians have not played a defense as fast and as effective as the U.S. yet. So I think, you know, we'll really be looking to see if they figure out how to adjust their game to deal with that and to deal with the American speed. You know, we'll be watching the U.S. goalie. He started off somewhat shaky last game against Czechoslovakia, so he'll need to be on his game because the U.S. has not played a team as good as Canada so far.
Is the U.S. hungry for some redemption after that crushing overtime loss in 2010?
Oh, definitely. I mean, you know, after the match was determined that it would be the U.S. and Canada, the men on the team were very happy. I mean, they basically had said this was their dream. This is what they wanted. So that's definitely on their mind.
You know, is there any crossover of spirit in a way between the men's hockey team and the women's hockey team? Are the men saying, hey, we've got to do our best here because we owe it to the women now to try to win the gold?
You know, I think the teams are supportive of each other. I mean, even though the women's game ended close to midnight last night, and even though the men had a game today, a lot of them were at that game. Amanda Ketzel, the star of the U.S., you know, one of the stars of the U.S. team, of course, her brother is on the men's team. So there's definitely crossover. The women were saying they hope the men can get some revenge for them. So I think there's some of that. But I think for the men, the sting of Vancouver is so big for them that's really what's driving them. You know, I don't know that it's going to be the women's loss that's driving them as much as this Vancouver, you know, as much as redemption, not just for Vancouver, but just for the U.S. program really not doing as well, as, you know, in years.
And hockey pretty much closes things out over in Sochi, but are there other events that you're going to be paying attention to today?
You know, I actually have been in a hockey bubble. So, you know, I know curling last night was, I didn't get to make it to a curling match. We're watching for any event that the Ukrainian team's in, given everything that's happening over there. So there's still some things going on that we're keeping an eye on.
Much of the talk leading up to the Olympics focused on security and preparations. You've been there for about 2 weeks now. What's the verdict on the success of the games?
Yeah, I mean, it's been, you know, there was a lot of chatter early on in the games about media hotel rooms not being ready, and certainly that was noticeable getting here. There's a lot of oddities, things like big, huge hotels that, you know, aren't finished yet, just things that, you know, are probably just cultural differences that I think are unusual to people here. But beyond that, you know, the transportation's running smoothly. There hasn't been any type of attack or security threat. So I think, you know, I think you'll hear people calling these games, you know, maybe not perfect, but a success after this.
Mm-hmm. Any clues as to what to expect at the closing ceremony on Sunday?
You know, they've been keeping that very good secret. I mean, you meet people around here, and I've met a couple of people who are in the ceremony, and they talk, and then they say they can't speak about what the ceremony is going to be like. So I actually don't know what to expect. I mean, I would expect something similar to the opening ceremony, the same kind of mood. I'm sure Putin will be there.
I imagine. Well, Sharon Turlip, thank you so much for joining us from Sochi, and have a safe trip home.
Great. Thank you. Glad to be here.
Sharon Turlip is a sports reporter at The Wall Street Journal. She's been covering hockey direct from Sochi, including today's USA-Canada game.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. There's an expectation that if a person works hard and stays loyal to their employer, they'll eventually be able to retire. But for some in Wisconsin nearing retirement age, that goal is being cut short. As Rich Kramer reports, thousands of people 45 years and older are considered long-term unemployed and are facing extra challenges their younger job-seeking counterparts don't.
Les Pintock has a degree in microelectronics. In 1999, he was hired by a company called Celestica in Chippewa Falls to inspect microchips. He says he noticed workflow slowing down and small groups of people getting laid off in the early 2000s.
From a personal perspective, I started to get pretty worrisome. You know, and then one day in spring of 2004, they came and said, yeah, we're being shut down. That was that.
Pintock, who is now 60 years old, hasn't had a full-time job since. Two businesses he started failed, and last month he filed for bankruptcy to keep his house. He says he's sent out hundreds of resumes and even worked with employment agencies. That led to interviews, but no callbacks. So, with the help of a federal program, Pintock went back to school, learning how to drive semis. He hopes that will land him a job in North Dakota's oil fields.
I never thought this would happen, you know, and right now I need this job so bad that if it doesn't happen, they dismiss my Chapter 13, which means I lose my truck and I don't have much else of value anymore, then goes to home. So, and the bank would just be happy as I'll get out for that to happen.
Pintock isn't alone. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the unemployment rate for people between the ages of 45 and 64 is around 4.5%. That's less than the overall employment rate, but for the people behind those numbers, the ones closing in on retirement age, it's earth-shattering. Ed Steinecker is an employment and training specialist at the Wisconsin Job Center in Eau Claire. He says about half of the people he sees come through the door are more senior workers who have been laid off.
We have noticed here at the Eau Claire Job Center that a lot of our groups, our participants, do appear to be older, whatever our definition of older is. Individuals start sharing with me, they wonder, is it my age? Right around the age of 50, sometimes as young as 45.
Steinecker says people of all ages can have trouble looking for jobs, but the older one gets, the more stigmas they face.
The bottom line, it's a tough economy, tough looking for work. It may not be my age, or employers might have a perception, have I kept up with my skills? Am I more costly? Perhaps employers might think they're going to be paying a higher salary and get the label overqualified.
Even going back to school has its challenges for people in this age group. Cindy Lindner enrolled at Wisconsin Indian Head Technical College after her manufacturing job in Osceola was moved to Mexico in 2012. Her computer skills aren't on par with her 18 and 19-year-old classmates, and she struggled with online classes.
It was very humiliating for me. because I didn't know what I was getting myself into, and I had no idea what I was doing.
Lindner says being back in college at age 50 has been overwhelming at times, but she's excited for the future.
It's my dream. It's always been my dream to be able to work someday with people and to be able to get up in the morning and know that I'm actually going to love my job because this is what I've always wanted to do.
Lindner will graduate in May with a degree in human services, something she says she couldn't have done while working full-time in a factory. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And that's the last installment in WPR's long-term unemployment series. If you missed any of them, you can head over to WPR.org where you can listen to the series in its entirety.
There seems to be no end in sight to the bloody three-year civil war in Syria. More than 100,000 people have already been killed, 4 million people are internally displaced, and more than 2 million have been forced to flee to neighboring countries.
As aid organizations struggle to get critical supplies to the people trapped in war zones, the tide of refugees continues to swell. What's the impact of the ongoing crisis on the refugees and the region?
Andrea Koppel is with us to give us an insider's view. She is vice president Department of Global Engagement and Policy at the Global Humanitarian Agency called Mercy Corps. Her organization is currently working with about 2 million refugees in countries like Jordan, Lebanon, and Iraq. Andrea, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Sure. Well, to bring listeners up to speed, could you give us a snapshot of the Syrian crisis in humanitarian terms?
Sure. Without a doubt, this is the most complex emergency that we at Mercy Corps have ever faced, and we're in the business for over 30 years. In terms of the refugees and the internally displaced people, I'm not sure when your numbers were updated, but I hate to shock your listeners even more, but there are even more internally displaced people and refugees than you mentioned in your introduction there. You have now over 9 million Syrians who are internally displaced. Over half of them are children. Many of those are people who have had no access to humanitarian aid in months upon months upon months, and they're in besieged areas. In other words, the Syrian military, or for that matter, other armed actors are blocking any access to humanitarian groups. In neighboring countries, I'll just go from the largest and then to the fewest number of refugees. The largest number of refugees are in Lebanon. 20% of the population in Lebanon are now Syrian refugees. You've got over 800,000 Syrians in a country of 4.4 million people. In Jordan, the Kingdom of Jordan, you have 600,000. These are all registered refugees. They're believed to be upwards of 1.4 million. So in other words, you've got more than double who are perhaps unregistered. That's 10 to 25% of the Jordanian population, depending upon which numbers you want to use. Then you've got Turkey, which has 527,000 refugees that are living there. And finally, in Iraq, you have 208,000. So all told, you have about 3 million refugees living in neighboring countries, and 9 million out of what had been a population of 23 million inside Syria who are internally displaced, Cynthia.
Wow. And that's, I mean, there's a lot of chaos, obviously, in the region. I'm just curious how you're able to keep these records.
Well, these records are kept by the UN humanitarian organizations. So they're the ones who, when refugees come into a country, they're set up in such a way that they're able to process the refugees, and then they record them. But, you know, there are some refugees, for example, in Lebanon, who are afraid to register or who may not even have the money to get from one part of Lebanon to another to get themselves registered because they don't have money for a taxi or a bus or whatever it might be. And they're afraid they might be sent back, even though that isn't the case because these are countries, all the neighboring countries are keeping their borders open to allow refugees to cross. But these are people who've been traumatized and who are living in incredibly difficult circumstances in these host countries. Even though some aid is reaching them, it's not enough.
You visited the Syrian refugee camps in the past, and you're going again in March. Can you, in just a couple of minutes here, sketch for us the daily life of a refugee? What conditions are they facing once they cross the border?
Sure. Well, let me speak to one refugee camp, the largest. It's actually now the fourth largest city in Jordan, the equivalent of a city. It's the Zaatari refugee camp in the north part of the country. There are, at any given time, between 80 to 100,000 refugees who are living in this camp. You drive through it. It's called a city because you're driving through the main road there, and you see shops on both sides. There are tents everywhere, but you'll see shops, you'll see a barber, stole. You'll see people selling shoes, selling sweets, a video arcade, or where kids can go and pay a little money and get on the computer. If you need to, you know, get something fixed, you'll see a little place where a repair shop might be. You, in this camp that's run by UNHCR, you also have the World Food Program that has vouchers for people to come and get food. You have some schools, Mercy Corps, my organization, runs some child-friendly spaces where kids can go and play and watch some movies and whatnot.
And Andrea, we'll pick that up after the news. We're talking with Andrea Koppel. She's Vice President of Global Engagement and Policy at the Global Humanitarian Agency, Mercy Corps.
And are you following the humanitarian crisis in Syria? Have you been part of the effort to get aid to the region? You can call with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You're listening to Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're looking at the humanitarian crisis in Syria with Andrea Koppel, Vice President of Global Engagement and Policy at the Global Humanitarian Agency Mercy Corps. And we want to know, are you following the humanitarian crisis in Syria? Have you been part of the effort to get aid to the region? And what questions do you have about the situation? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or email us at talk@WPR.org.
Andrea, before the news, you were painting a picture of us for us of Zaatari, the refugee camp in Jordan. And it sounds like quite, as you described it, its own city. Is that representative of some of the other refugee camps in the region?
Well, I think the answer is probably no. I don't think there's another camp that is the same size as Zaatari in Jordan. But in Turkey, I can tell you there was a story, I think, in the New York Times in the last week that talked about the refugee camps in that country that have been established by the government, and that they are so, you know, nice, relatively speaking. There are some of these camps that actually have washers and dryers. There are some that actually have satellite, small satellite dishes where you could watch satellite television. That is clearly on the far extreme of what you would find in terms of it being slightly more comfortable. But in a place like Lebanon, for example, there are no refugee camps, and that's because of Lebanon's very, very long and tortured past with accepting hundreds of thousands of refugees from the Palestinian territories, for example, and they had camps, and the people never went home. And we know that's because of the problems with Israel and the Palestinians. But nonetheless, they don't want to follow that precedent. So the refugees in Lebanon, and there are 800,000 of them, are living in urban areas. And, you know, that's another mess.
In media reports, Mercy Corps staff members have called this the defining war and humanitarian crisis of the decade. What makes this crisis so much more complex and difficult, especially in terms of humanitarian efforts?
That's a great question. And I'm sure your listeners may be wondering the same thing, because we hear so often about terrible humanitarian crises, and it just sounds like hyperbole to talk about the Syria crisis as being the most complex and the worst. And the reason is that you have so many moving pieces, and the fact that it has gone on as long as it has. In the middle of March, so in the middle of next month, the Syrian war will have continued for 3 years, and there is no end in sight. You have a hot war going on inside Syria with over 9 million internally displaced people. Half of them are children. You have foreign fighters. You have Syrian opposition who are fighting the government. And you now have Al-Qaeda offshoots that are moving into North Syria, taking control of the country. You have the U.S. intelligence chief, James Clapper, who warned in the last couple of weeks that the Syrian civil war is a huge magnet for terror groups, and that he sees this as being something that is a national security threat to the United States. Then you have Syria's neighbors, Lebanon and Jordan and Iraq and Turkey, that are groaning under the hundreds of thousands of refugees that they are hosting. And with the exception of Turkey, they're all fragile states. These are countries that were poor, that were struggling to meet the needs of their own population 3 years ago. So you can imagine how this has complicated matters. And then you have the fact that there is so much assistance, so much humanitarian aid that's needed, and governments like ours here in the United States are struggling with our own challenges. And while the U.S. has without a doubt been the most generous of all the international donors, we are still only one-third of the way to meeting the appeal that was made by the United Nations for humanitarian assistance for Syria.
We have Rich in Woodstock, Illinois on the line. Rich, what's your question?
Oh, thank you for taking my call. I feel like my question appears lightweight, and maybe it is, and maybe your guest can tell me that. But I've been in Sierra Leone after the Civil War ended there. I'm a teacher, and I'm looking at retirement, and I didn't realize going over there helping teachers. I was there to train teachers because their schools were destroyed during the war, and a lot of their teachers were killed during the war. So I went there to do small workshops training teachers to help them try to reestablish their schools. And I just thought, okay, it's good to have schools, but because I'm a teacher, I didn't realize how much stability schools brought and how much hope schools brought. I mean, I know that, but I really realized that much more going there, how important the education component is in a country if it's going to recover from a war. I'm just wondering, does your organization do anything with providing some type of schooling, even if it's not ongoing schooling, something for helping either train teachers, displaced teachers, or train, or just do, you know, some okay. type of schooling?
Thanks. Thanks, Rich. What about that, Andrea? What efforts are focused on education?
Rich, that was an incredibly thoughtful question and, frankly, very prescient, because Mercy Corps is part of a campaign that's rolling out now that's called the No Lost Generation Campaign, along with UNICEF and World Vision and Save the Children. And it is exactly about that, that you have children, Syrian children, who have been out of school now, in some instances, for 3 years. And if you do not address both the education needs of these children, but also the psychological needs of these children, you are at risk of losing an entire generation. So this is something that is a huge priority for Mercy Corps. We're working to help children manage the trauma that they've been through, but are also looking to find ways to get them in school, the right kinds of coursework, and the right kind of support from teachers. So I'm so glad he asked that question.
The UN Security Council is set to vote on a resolution to boost humanitarian aid access in Syria tomorrow. What do you know about this resolution, and what impact might it have?
Oh, that is a great question, another terrific question. And let me see if I can explain this in as clear a way as possible. Since October, the UN Security Council had issued what's known as a presidential statement. It doesn't have as much weight as a Security Council resolution, calling for humanitarian access inside Syria. This is under international humanitarian law. This is not saying Syria is an exception. It's saying this is the way that it should be. Remember I had mentioned there are 6 million people in besieged areas who haven't had access to any kind of humanitarian aid for months upon months upon months. this resolution is supposed to have a little more teeth to urge both the Syrian government and then the other combatants, the others engaged in fighting the Syrian government, to allow access. The problem is, without the threat of force, without the threat of putting boots on the ground, it is not likely to have much force behind it. We can only hope that all parties to the conflict will allow civilians. We're not talking about combatants. We're talking about children. We're talking about old people. We're talking about women and those who have not taken up arms, to give them food, water, warm clothing, and some kind of shelter. But there are people who are and in need of medical care, desperately in need of that. So we'd like to be hopeful that this will change people's minds. And perhaps I should just end on that positive note.
Well, I was going to ask you, what do Syrians need most right now, do you think? And how can people who are listening at home right now help out?
I appreciate that question a lot. And I mentioned that United Nations humanitarian appeal that is only one-third funded. There are so many challenges out there, and the best thing that people can do if they want to help, and we would certainly be incredibly grateful. There are a lot of very good organizations out there, and I happen to think Mercy Corps is one of them. You know, go to, if you're interested in Mercy Corps, it's Mercy, MercyCorp, like Peter, .org, and you can give to the Syria Crisis. If you have another charity of choice, I would go there. But look for the reputable organizations that are trying to address both the immediate humanitarian needs, which are immense, but remember, there is no end in sight. So we need also long-term solutions, long-term ways of getting at the needs that are more efficient and effective, and spend aid dollars in the smartest way possible.
Andrea, thank you so much for joining us today.
Cynthia, thank you so much.
That was Andrea Koppel, Vice President of Global Engagement and Policy at the humanitarian organization called Mercy Corps. She leads the organization's global advocacy on humanitarian and development issues, including the Syria crisis. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll talk about why some writers say science fiction is the perfect vehicle to explore big questions and hidden corners in our world. But first, it's our state news roundup with WPR's Noah Ovshinsky. Noah's our assistant news director. Noah, thanks for stopping by.
It's good to be here, as always.
So the big story out of Wisconsin this week was the release of thousands of pages of emails relating to the John Doe investigation. So let's start there. Fill us in on what happened.
Right. So this was by far the biggest story, at least as far as the media was concerned, and it involves 27,000 pages of emails and documents from a former aide to Governor Walker, Kelly Reinfleisch. This is, of course, when he was the county executive in Milwaukee County, and it was sent at a time when he was running for governor. And these were documents, these were emails that the press have been pushing to get released, and they were finally released this week.
And given the volume of those emails, it didn't take long for the people digging through them to turn up some content of interest. What did they find?
Yeah, they show a few things. One of the biggest things I think these emails show is sort of the day in the life of a campaign. However, in this case, in pretty vivid detail, it shows that there was really extensive contact between the Walker campaign and Walker's county staff at the time. And it suggests both that there was a lot of contact and a lot of coordination. The emails also show, strongly suggest that there was a behind-the-scenes network of private email addresses people use in order to conduct their campaign business. And of course, because they were private emails, they would be shielded from the public.
And
And in terms of why this is a sticking point, for people who don't know, this is, I guess, illegal to do campaign work on government time. Is that it?
Right. In Wisconsin, you can, if you're a state worker, a government worker, you know, you're getting paid with taxpayer money, that's a big no-no. You can't do campaign work while you're being paid, you know, by the taxpayers, essentially. And that's what got several of Governor Walker's former staff members in trouble, including Kelly Reinfleisch. And that's what they were convicted of eventually during the first John Doe investigation.
So this story has been pretty hot in the blogosphere. It made the New York Times, a whole bunch of other publications. But what has it meant so far for Governor Walker?
Well, I think, you know, I hate to hedge my bets here, but I mean, the jury is still out. And I mean, obviously, one of the reasons why people are paying attention to this, especially in the national media, is Governor Walker is considered a potential contender in the next presidential race. So people are paying attention. I mean, that's why he was in the New York Times. And so people are paying attention. And of course, people are always on the lookout for the smell of scandal or any kind of scandal. We saw that with Governor Chris Christie in New Jersey with Bridgegate. And so that's why it's gotten a lot of attention for here, us in Wisconsin. Wisconsin, I think it, you know, these emails clearly paint a picture of what DeWalker's campaign was like at the time. But for the governor, you know, he was never charged, you know, and, you know, supporters and legal experts will point out that, you know, if these emails had proved any kind of misconduct on the governor's part, that he would have been charged during the John Doe investigation. And he never was. And so while they may not paint a really pretty picture of his campaign and paints a picture of close coordination between his county staff at the time and his campaign, you know, it's a political problem for the governor at this point. At least it's not a criminal one.
And do you have a sense of how this information has been digested so far?
Yeah. And you, thank you for prefacing all of this by saying so far, because, you know, we're still in the beginning of the story. But I think how people, the public in Wisconsin and others, digest this information, you know, will largely depend on how they feel about the governor in general. If you're a supporter of the governor, I think you'll probably, you know, dismiss it or minimize it, considering the governor wasn't charged. You know, prosecutors didn't find proof of misconduct. If you are a critic of the governor, as of course the Democratic Party is and others, they point to this as you know, evidence of corruption and the fact that the governor at the time, you know, that he was, you know, a central part of this coordination. And so I think it largely depends on how you feel about the governor in general.
So is this the end of John Doe?
No, this is not. Well, it's the end of that John Doe investigation. That's officially closed. But there is another John Doe investigation going on right now. We don't know a lot about it because the nature of John Doe investigations, they're largely done in secret. We do know that it involves the alleged coordination between the recall campaigns with Governor Walker and others and outside political groups. We know that it deals with that alleged coordination. But we don't know much more than that.
So that's one still TBD.
Still ongoing. And I'm sure we'll know more and we'll certainly hear more in the next few months.
Well, from the governor to the legislature now, the assembly worked late last night, got some key pieces of legislation passed. What do we need to know about last night's session?
Yeah, so this was a big week for the assembly. They passed some key bills. And again, I'm cherry picking here based on, you know, what I think is interesting, what I think our listeners are interested in, because they did do a lot this week. And two of the ones I want to talk about deal with the ever delicate issue of local control. And one of the things the assembly passed this week was a bill that really restricts the ability of local governments to enact so-called living wage ordinances. Right now, Dane County, the city of Milwaukee, and Madison, they all pay certain contractors and government workers more per hour. And Milwaukee County was hoping to do the same thing. Under this bill that passed the assembly, they can't do that now if the projects or services are paid for using state funds. So that's, again, a big issue, certainly for Dane County, City of Milwaukee, Madison, again, all governments that have these living wage ordinances.
So that would represent a change for Madison and Milwaukee. Milwaukee County not quite on board yet, but this would put a stop to that.
Yeah, and any other counties that are potentially looking at doing a living wage ordinance, those will not be allowed for people who are in jobs that use or are funded by state money.
So another bill that went through in the assembly compels Milwaukee to sell vacant public school buildings. Tell us about this one.
Right. Again, another issue of local control. Private schools have said for a while in Milwaukee that in some cases they haven't been allowed to buy these vacant properties or underused properties. They allege because they're seen as competition by the Milwaukee public schools. This bill essentially makes it easier for those private schools to purchase these properties. And again, it's an issue of local control because critics of this bill will say, well, what is the assembly doing? What is state government doing telling the city of Milwaukee what to do with their vacant buildings? So again, another controversial bill, and that's one that just passed the assembly this week as well.
So obviously that would mean a diversity of schools aside from the Milwaukee Public School District should that move forward.
Yeah, and we're talking, I think, somewhere between 15 and 20 buildings right now, depending on who you ask. They're all vacant, and private schools and others want access to those buildings. They want to be able to bid for those buildings, and this bill will make it easier.
And there are a couple of miscellaneous things you wanted to talk about that passed the assembly. One regards the way doctors communicate with their patients.
Yeah, so I found this to be fascinating because this is something that's happening around the country. This bill that passed the assembly, essentially it prevents a doctor's apology from becoming the basis of a medical malpractice lawsuit. Because right now, doctors, hospitals, insurers, they are very hesitant to actually apologize because they're afraid that that apology can be used as a basis for a lawsuit. And what this bill does is it prevents that apology from becoming the basis of a lawsuit. Supporters say, of course, that this kind of bill will help free up the communication between doctors and patients and patients' families. Critics of the bill, including attorneys, say this bill gives doctors special treatment in the eyes of the law. Of course, on the attorney's part, it will make it harder for them to file and win malpractice lawsuits. So it makes sense, perhaps, that they would be against this.
I just want to get a handle on what this means. So this is a scenario in which, let's say, a patient dies under a doctor's care.
Yes.
And a doctor might come out and say, I'm sorry this happened, but apparently this can be used to litigate.
Exactly. Lawyers and the families of patients can use that apology against the doctor in many states. But what's interesting is there's this movement going on right now. And I think this bill that we're talking about right now relates to this movement is allowing the doctors the freedom to apologize in these cases. And in fact, there are some hospitals, Johns Hopkins, among others, that are actually urging doctors to apologize because studies show that that over time, people sue less if doctors apologize. And so in the long run, at least some evidence suggests that it can save money and avoid potentially costly lawsuits.
That's interesting because obviously hospitals worry that there's a link between apologies and lawsuits that would lead to more lawsuits. You're saying the evidence actually says maybe less.
Yeah, there is some evidence to suggest that right now. And of course, this goes against the grain of hospitals and insurers, because they've long promoted what in the business, there's a strategy they call defend and deny. And what this bill we're talking about in the assembly does and other bills across the country and the movement in general to allow doctors to apologize is it sort of turns it on its head and say basically it's acknowledge and apologize.
The human component, maybe.
Exactly.
Interesting.
Exactly.
Noah, thank you so much for stopping by and talking today.
It was good to be here. Thanks.
That was Noah Ovshinsky, WPR's assistant news director.
Coming up, we'll geek out on the strange worlds and big questions of science fiction. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.